Corpus Christi, a courtroom fluorescent and calm, trying hard to look like a place that fixes things. Three teachers walked in and described the moment the world bent for them and never straightened again. They spoke of a man in black, of backpacks, and of guns pointed at playgrounds. They spoke of rooms that became tombs and hallways that became wrong answers. Two teachers tried to summon help the way anyone summons help now. A smartwatch and a phone call. One used a wrist device to reach 911 and then stopped speaking because she feared that speaking would invite death through the door. Her voice climbed into panic as she pleaded for officers to hurry. A child crawled onto her back and tried to make it okay. That touch did not fix anything, but it did something human. Another teacher felt metal and glass bite her. Shrapnel hit her. She lost her glasses and wrestled with an impossible thought that she had led the children into the worst place. She crawled between windows and her students, told them she loved them until the words ran out, and waited for rescue through a window. The man the defense says helped pull children out is the same man on trial for not having helped enough. A third teacher ran to call about a crash, and then watched the story change into massacre. Her 911 call recorded a slow extinguishing of hope. She expected death. The legal record now contains her fear, repeatable and formal. Filed next to policies about door locks, outside the human testimony, technicians spoke of casings and bullet paths. There were measured angles and neat diagrams for something that shredded ordinary life. Prosecutors are building those measurements into a story that the first officer on the scene did not act. The defendant faces 29 counts of child abandonment and endangerment and has pleaded not guilty. The indictment is precise, the grief is not. One witness offered a detail about seeing the shooter where an officer would later arrive. That detail was later declared unusable. The defense forced the judge to tell jurors to ignore the whole of her testimony because she had not spoken the same way right after the massacre. The judge said it reluctantly. Everyone in the room knew what that means. A human memory can be struck from the record like an inconvenient annotation, but you cannot strike silence from the building where children died. Families wept as recordings and testimony played. The jury listened. Lawyers argued about what counts as evidence, about what counts as an excuse. The trial will go on. The prosecution will call more witnesses. The defense will cross and object. The machine of law will churn through grief and evidence, polite and thorough, as if process could stitch bone. This is what we have learned to do in public. Turn loss into exhibit numbers, turn trauma into testimony, turn the fact that a uniformed officer is on trial into proof that the system once again failed to stop what it was supposed to prevent. We have trained entire institutions to make sure the paperwork is neat while other things are left messy and broken. There is a kind of horror in watching adults in a courtroom try to contain something that will not be contained. The record grows. The counts multiply. The cameras blink. People fold their hands and pronounce their sorrow in the language of procedure. Outside the courtroom, there are classrooms that will never be the same and parents who will never be whole. The case will continue tomorrow. The law will attempt to assign blame and excuse. The rest of us will take the testimony home where silence and smart watches and glass will keep replaying while the city continues to live its ordinary life around impossible absence. We watch, we file, we argue, we grieve, and the world keeps offering the same thin comforts. Policies reviewed, motions heard, a judge who says he is reluctant.
First world problems. They demolished the East Wing, started digging into a Cold War bunker, and now they want to build an 89,000 square foot addition with a 22,000 square foot ballroom that seats 1,000 people. Which is to say, when your house is already huge, the new problem is that your party space might be slightly disproportional. Architect says it will rationalize functions, increase connectivity, and let the White House age in a more graceful way. Translation: we're adding a grand staircase, a movie theater, and a first lady suite because the existing footprint supposedly doesn't flow for hors d'oeuvres. The building will be set back exactly 10.5 feet and painted white, because if you're expanding the most famous house in America, the first priority is matching the cornice so the Instagram lighting stays uniform. Critics called the rendering disturbing and overwhelming, which is fair. It's like discovering your neighbor built a second living room the size of a Costco. One commissioner wants it shrunk. The chairman, handpicked by the White House, is quite impressed. So the process looks less like review and more like a design by committee where the committee already RSVP'd yes. There's also talk of adding a second-story colonnade to restore a sense of symmetry. Symmetry. Because when the entire country is a study in imbalance, you can always restore architectural equilibrium. Nothing says national unity like matching porches. Meanwhile, the Planning Commission spent an hour arguing about lampposts, mesh enclosures for a zoo habitat, and three types of bike bridge railings. They'll pore over street-level renderings while a ballroom that's bigger than the executive mansion quietly grows out back. That's very on-brand. Agonize over which lamppost looks tasteful while approving an 89,000-square-foot upgrade. Also, bonus feature, a movie theater in the White House. Finally, a spot to watch whatever State of the Union they show in IMAX. And the bunker gets top-secret upgrades, which apparently required first tearing down whatever was above it. Top-secret demolition. It's the new normal. First world problem, level national. Our biggest architectural crisis is whether the White House will have the right setback and a cornice that photographs well. Meanwhile, the rest of the planet watches us debate lampposts and ballroom capacity as if the emergency were square footage, not, you know, everything else.
The quickest thing about this episode was the verdict. Within hours of an ICE agent killing a Minneapolis woman, the White House had already given her a role in the new national theater. Deliberate attacker, member of a left-wing conspiracy, and, best of all, domestic terrorist. It's comforting, in a cheap way, that labeling moves faster than investigation. A day later, the vice president gently unraveled that performance. He conceded that maybe the woman panicked, maybe she wasn't aiming for an officer, maybe the heart of the matter is unknowable. The administration's story shifted from certainty to conjecture without admitting the original certainty ever existed. That's politics in 2026. Start with a headline-ready accusation, then let the adjectives fall where they may. This isn't a mere spat about phrasing. Calling a dead person a terrorist does two things at once. It makes a violent state action feel justified, and it weaponizes grief into propaganda. Families start mourning while the state files a PR claim. Officials who prefer not to be dragged into theatrical certainty offer the reasonable silence of professionals, only to be overshadowed by the loud, declarative instincts of power. The result is predictable and ugly. Anger amplified, facts optional, and civic trust ground down further. The larger pattern matters more than this single case. When the default is to announce malice before evidence, the machinery for normalizing force tightens. Words like terrorism and conspiracy get thrown like grenades at any inconvenient person, and the men who run the show watch the shockwaves, sometimes with a wink, sometimes with a hasty correction. Either way, the public ends up knee-deep in narratives, not truth. Watch the playbook. Immediate escalation. Vague collective enemies. Screenshots and soundbites that harden into law and order gospel. When one official mutes the fever and another fans it, the balance of power isn't between truth and lies, so much as between who gets to set the tone for grief. The tone wins more often than it should. The practical upshot is simple and grim. We are learning to accept dead people first as threats, then as problems to be explained away. That's how a society makes its way toward a normalization of state violence, one premature verdict at a time.
From the provided article titled "Patti Smith Talks with Anderson Cooper About Grief," from the content you supplied, Patti Smith and Anderson Cooper talking about grief sounds like the weightiest kind of human honesty. Then, embedded in the same frame, a list of digital complaints. The video player was slow, the video never loaded, the ad froze, the audio was too loud. The grand conversation about loss sits next to a grocery list of technical failures, as if mourning needs an update patch. Isn't that our era in a sentence? We try to face the big, quiet questions, what it means to lose someone, how to carry meaning, and the screen interrupts. Your content may not load. Click here to troubleshoot. Grief is intimate, raw, and timeless. Advertising is loud, impatient, and oddly confident. The ad refuses to cooperate. Grief keeps showing up whether the ad starts or not. There's an irony to advertising at the edges of sorrow. Someone decides to monetize attention, then the attention refuses to cooperate. The universe is oddly polite that way. It schedules deep feeling between pre-rolls and buffering icons. Even our sorrow becomes something to click through. Maybe that's the point. We are complex, fragile beings trying to find meaning, while the systems we've built insist on treating meaning like a unit of engagement. We mourn, the player stalls. We speak about loss, the ad is too loud. We try to communicate what matters most, and the world replies with a technical support ticket. And if anything about that isn't funny, at least it's honest. The absurdity of life is not that it lacks meaning, but that it keeps insisting on miracles and chores at once. We keep talking to each other about what hurts, while everything designed to distract us keeps buffering. We will keep asking the big questions and the small ones. Did the ad finish loading? And that, if nothing else, is the human condition. An earnest search for depth, interrupted by a very persistent click.
The capitalists fever dreamed the president announced an order to have $200 billion in mortgage bonds bought, not by the Federal Reserve, not through Congress, but by his representatives tapping cash from the government-controlled mortgage giants he kept in place. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, having been left on the public balance sheet, are suddenly a vault full of vote-winning rhetoric, enough cash to be a short-term fix and a long-term bargaining chip. There is a grotesque logic to it. Pump hundreds of billions of dollars into mortgage-backed securities, and bond prices rise, yields fall, headline mortgage rates might twitch down. It looks like action. It looks like relief. It is not, however, a solution. Buying securities reshapes financial markets, not neighborhoods. The Federal Reserve once played this game during the pandemic and delivered low rates only to a housing market that refused to move. Millions of homeowners locked into pandemic-era loans stayed put. Inventory never returned. Goldman Sachs says the country is roughly 4 million homes short. You cannot manufacture a roof over someone's head by trading paper. This is theater dressed up as policy. Public assets mobilized to massage markets so that mortgage math looks prettier for a bit. The same entities being lined up as cash machines are the ones being eyed for future IPOs. Privatize the upside. Socialize the stabilization. The regulatory agency put in charge signaled compliance, an administrative shrug that reads like permission to improvise the market. Whether such purchases can legally happen without Congress is murky. Legality rarely stops spectacle. Behind the stunt is a simpler confession. Housing in America is treated as an asset first and a home second. When scarcity is structural, when profits are the measurement of success, the government's role collapses into managing market optics. Buy bonds to shave fractions off interest rates while the underlying supply evaporates. Promise affordability with accounting moves, then sell the golden goose as a private opportunity. This is capitalism's fever dream, a scramble to tweak market signals rather than fix broken systems, to loot public balance sheets for temporary applause, and to turn the public's need for shelter into another product to be repackaged and sold. The result is a spectacle of policy without remedy, a country with too few houses and too many financial instruments pretending to care.